On further reading, we cover the career of actor and notorious Hellraiser Oliver Reed. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at the Joseph Losey directed The Damned, which is also known as These Are the Damned, a Hammer production that was filmed in 1961 but released in 1963.
Black leather, black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather.
Rock. I'm Leslie Hatton, and these are my co-hosts, Doug Tilley and Liam O'Donnell. Welcome.
Ahoy, ahoy.
I know that we're going to get into this later, but I just before we get into everything else, I want to ask the both of you. I know it's not my job to ask anyone anything. I'm not even the host here. What are those? Which of those titles do you prefer, The Damned or These Are the Damned?
Well, I did some research, mm-hmm. and it looked like they tried to tie it in with the Village of the Damned.
Ah, which makes sense with the poster art for this.
Mm-hmm. Because in the book, Children of Light, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The kids were all blonde. And so they thought, oh, we'll make it like a, you know, a fake tie-in to something that's already existing and popular.
I do kind of like the idea that radiation would turn them all blonde.
Yeah, almost that's like, actually a pretty fun idea.
Almost like being blonde is like they were burned or something. You know, that's mm-hmm. kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the book, it probably really sounds better.
Not really an answer to my question, by the way, from either of you.
I prefer The Damned, only mm-hmm. I find it very hard to believe that there aren't like 10 other movies named The Damned. It's just one of those names that I just feel like someone must have been using. I think These Are the Damned is fine. I think if it was named We Are the Damned, I'd be like, that's sick. That's some sick shit right there.
Yeah. Well, The Damned is a Visconti film, I believe, but I don't know if it came out before or after this. I can't speak to that.
Well, there's also the band The Damned, which yes. did they take their name from this movie?
Oh, I never thought of that. And I'm a fan. I didn't even think about that.
You talk. But I'll figure that out.
That would make sense. I mean, they do like, you know, horror movies and stuff. I mean, and it is an English movie. So that kind of would make sense. I like the synopsis that I found, which is an American visiting England falls in love, with the sister of a sadistic motorbike gang leader who drives them away with his threats. The pair retreat to a hideaway in a dank cave beneath a military base where a group of strange, abandoned children become their surrogate family, although I would change family to rescuers because they're there for like a day. However, the children hide a grim and fatal secret. That's like a pretty good synopsis.
It's a pretty good synopsis without giving away too much. By the way, I have discovered the origins of the band name The Damned. It does come from a movie, but it's not this movie. It's actually the 1969 one that you referred to just a little while ago.
Visconti?
Yes. At least according to encyclopedia.com.
Hmm. Okay. Can I say that? I don't want to harp on this, so I'll just mention it now, and then we can let it go and talk about more interesting things.
Okay.
I do think it's interesting that this synopsis refers to them as a motorcycle gang, considering I think there's only one bike between the six of them, eight of them, seven of them?
No, they all have bikes.
Yeah, they all have bikes.
When did they have bikes?
Do we see them like ride? Yeah.
Yeah, they're chasing the woman. Yeah, they do.
Remember at the very beginning? Well, at the very beginning, they're all just walking around, but eventually mm-hmm. they get on bikes. Remember they have to avoid like a dog or something at one point while they're all mm-hmm. driving on their bikes?
No, I don't remember that at all.
They're a motorcycle gang, bud. In fact,
they're not a motorcycle gang. The movie calls them Teddy Boys, and motorcycle gangs of Teddy Boys would fucking kill each other. So that's the first.
No, in jolly old England, they're one and the same, me
No,
boy.
They're not even close to the same.
Oh, they certainly are.
Oh, my God. I hate you so much. Yeah, I was bringing up the motor gang thing just to get to the, why do they call them Teddy Boys in the movie? Like, they're not even visually similar.
Do they refer to them as Teddy Boys?
Multiple times, and I don't understand why, because the whole point of the Teddy Boys is they had those weird duck whatever the haircut is where you swoop it up and it's like in the front.
Well, Oliver Reed sort of has one, ducktail.
Yeah, ducktail. He's a little close, but the rest of them, mm-hmm. it's not even similar. And by the 60s, they weren't even really relevant anymore. It's like it's like you make a movie in 1978 and call everybody hippies. And it's like, all right, buddy, that's not even really a thing anymore, really.
I think it's probably that it's like the tail end of that sort of trend. Right? Because I know that they usually refer to the way that the Beatles looked in Hamburg, the way that they had the leather jackets and stuff like that. I mean, that they were referred to as Teddy Boys, which obviously doesn't, they more resemble the Oliver Reed type look in this movie than it would what you're probably thinking.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if it was like, and this probably ties into things we're going to talk about later. It's just a remnant of something that people remembered as like being kind of scary. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, it was like,
I think that I don't
know, they're like Teddy Boys or whatever, you know, it's like, oh, there's a bunch of kids and they're bad. So we'll just call them anything.
Yeah. Like, they listen to Marilyn Manson or they're goths or whatever.
They listen
that would
to
be
the Marilyn
in the
90s. Manson. The Marilyn Manson of the time in this movie, which goes kill, kill, oh kill, God. Black leather rock.
The song. Oh my God. When I heard it, when I rewatched it, I don't remember thinking this the first time I saw it, but when I watched it again, it made me think of the Hike Up Your Chinos song from Mystery Science Theater.
The funny thing about the song is like it's like the song has possessed the characters and that they're all whistling it and singing it and humming it for the first 15 minutes of the movie. It's like they can't. It's like this is our mantra. Like this is what tells the world what we're all about.
They use it as like a call on the island.
Yes,
yes.
It is like it's them. It's like it's so them, and it is the most ridiculous. It does. I don't know if this is the case, but to me, it feels like. Like an old person's idea of what rock and roll was from just kind of getting a sense of, so like it's being described to them. It's like, it's really aggressive music. Okay. Rock, rock, rock.
if someone presented that as like a caricature song, you know what I mean? Like as a joke song, you'd be like, this is a little over the top, man. I don't know.
Yeah, it does. It feels like, that song. I mean, the Hike Up Your Chinos song, which is like a fake, you know, they made it up. But in the movie, I think it's the Beatniks, one of the two Beatnik movies on Mystery Science Theater, they have a song that's like
leather coat.
It's like leather coat.
Ducktail.
Wait a minute, kids.
And that's the guy's like hit song or whatever. And he becomes all famous, but then his degenerate beatnik friends get into trouble and drag him down. Of course, they're teenagers, but they all look like they're 40. So it also sounded like that song.
It's so funny to think between when this movie was filmed in 1961 and when it was released in the UK in 1963, how different music was between those 2 years.
Oh, like my God.
The whole fucking world changed. It must have felt very strange watching this in UK cinemas in the midst of like the early stages and actually mid stages of Beatlemania. It must have been crazy.
Oh yeah, for sure. I know you, Doug, had sent that article about the differences between the book and the movie, which I thought was really interesting, and how they changed things in the film, like they created the sculptor character and a few other things that were different. Because I think in the book there was a journalist who got involved, and they cut him out because he didn't really fit with the way that they had the story. But they put that sculptor character in, or sculptress, I guess, because she was sort of more like the conscience of the movie and was more of a representation of, okay, if you want to be anti-establishment, there's ways to do it that aren't like beating up people and stealing their wallets. And I really like her character, but I mean, so there's that whole like street gangs thing, the street gangs anxiety and the fear, but there's the whole Cold War thing and like post World War II and the anxiety of that. And so that kind of goes into the science fiction aspects of it, because obviously the things that happen aren't real, but it's this sort of dystopian thing. Like this might be what it turns into if we're not careful.
In some ways, it seemed like the book is even more like, this is a very cynical movie, but in some ways it seems like the book might be even more cynical in the sense that one of the big differences is that, and I don't want to give too much away right yet because we're going to get into it anyway, but the crux of the children in this movie and why they're being separated from society has to do with the future. While and it does in the book as well, but it has to do with the fact that all the Cold War tests have already fucked humanity. Like, it's already done in the context of the book. In this one, it's just about, oh, the world is fucked. It's already past the tipping point. We need to prepare for what's coming next. It seems a little more... we know that the character, I'm going to call him the mad scientist character, even though it's very unfair to the character and how he's presented in the movie. That character is like, this is going to happen. He is totally of the belief that nuclear holocaust is what is going to be in the future for the world. But that it's almost even worse to think that, oh, just in the preparation for that, we've already fucked the world, you know? That to me is maybe the more cynical view of what... Again, I haven't read the book. I'm only going from that summary, but it certainly sounds that way.
I do like the way that the guy who wrote that article talked about how he saw the movie, loved the movie, and then wanted to read the book and had his name on some sort of list, waited like 8 years or something to get a copy of the book. I was like, I respect that flex, because that is so a thing I would do. Like, I can't wait to get this. I can't wait to get this book or this obscure random thing that nobody gives a shit about except me. And then after all that time, I'm like, okay, now I can write my article. That was pretty dedicated.
Absolutely.
What did you think about, and I don't know if you got a chance to look at it, but the article that Keith Allison wrote about how it's a folk horror. He would put it in a folk horror category, specifically a type of folk horror that crosses over with science fiction. I really liked that argument and his explanations of why he felt that way. I thought that was really cool.
It's a terrific article, and it made me rethink how I considered the movie. I would never, while I was watching it, it didn't even cross my mind that this was folk horror. And of course, the concept of folk horror has really caught fire in genre film loving circles over the past like 3 or 4 years because of the documentary about folk horror. And I mean, you know, and because of the box set of folk horror movies and things like that, it didn't really cross my mind. So reading that article, really, I started to kind of rethink the elements of it. The fact that it's about a foreigner coming to this area, the fact that it's kind of this remote part, that it's very much about the land and the land being tainted in some way. And but the mix of science fiction into that, I just haven't seen a lot of movies, or at least I haven't considered movies from that perspective that envelop that. I'm curious about Liam's perspective on that, and the fact that I believe, Liam, that you didn't have a lot of an idea of what this movie was going to be going in. So the way that this movie is set up, where it's like the first, half hour, 45 minutes, you could think that it's just this kind of teenage delinquent movie, and then it turns into this other science fiction thing. How surprised were you with you probably knew something was going to happen from poster art or something like that, but did this movie take a big twist for you?
I definitely started the movie before I saw the poster art. I just knew we were watching some movie, right? And I saw it was called The Damned, and I thought, and I think I saw like an image somewhere online and was like, oh, okay, it's another, you know, because the last one we did, the name's escaping me, the Beach Town
Sex movie. The System.
Yeah. Yes. It very much is not, you know, leather-bound rebels, but it still is about teens or young people doing weird sort of... antisocial things, you know, so
in a
beach town. So I think that's why it was in my brain. But as the movie got going, a couple things started to occur to me that made me ready for the direction. One was that this character is not nearly as strong as the character he played in the other movie.
Right.
And I thought, well, I don't think they're going to hang the movie on creepy old perv man and his young lover. So there's got to be some other attraction here. And then I was curious about who this creepy old perv man was. And so when I went to look the letterbox up and I saw the poster for the movie, I thought, oh, this is a horror movie. And then I realized the conversation I'd already started between the artist and the older bureaucrat who is clearly morally corrupt. And
right.
And once their conversation started, he started talking about his secrets. I'm like, oh, now, Doug, actually, the thing I wanted to mention about that is that what I got excited about here was not whether this was or was not a angry teens movie, because in a way, it still kind of is an angry teens movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that I feel like we're in this zone. And this happens a lot, right, when you transition from one decade to another. So, like, movies that were filmed in 1981 can sometimes look very much like movies from the 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
This movie, it is one of those films that, on one hand, it has a lot of the science gone wrong of 50s sci-fi horror, right?
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah.
But with the bleakness, and, like, not that we weren't fully aware of the possibility of nuclear annihilation in the 50s, right? But in the 50s... we hadn't yet gotten quite as jaded about it. So you had things that were pretty bleak with science, but there's just something a bit more bitter in this. Like, it almost feels more personal. And I thought, ooh, this feels like a mushing together of, like, what will happen in the 60s with what was already going on in the 50s. And it kind of squeezing those things together, because the anxiety about the youth was much stronger in the 60s than in the 50s. But they insist on calling these guys Teddy Boys, which was a threat from the 50s. And I just thought, wow, this movie really is between two eras of a genre film,
right?
And kind of smushes them together very, very well, I thought. And I honestly, Doug, when I realized the level of, like, bleak sci-fi we were getting, while also, I mean, this is the thing you can say about this movie: it's very depressing, also kind of corny, like a bit cornball.
Sure, absolutely.
And I gotta say, I don't watch a lot of movies that fit that, right? Like, I don't have a whole, I couldn't list the many movies that I would say it's kind of goofy, but also it ends in a way that you can't help but be sad about. I bet that's more often than I know, even, and I'm not fully familiar with it.
Yeah, it's goofy without being camp, right? So it's deadly serious in how it presents itself, and that's the really kind of odd thing. When you think about that melding of what the 50s and 60s sci-fi in the U.S. would look like, the 50s being, you know, science gone awry, giant monsters and things like that, and 60s being more about the paranoia of the Cold War, this one isn't based on the paranoia of, you know, who's a Russian, who's a spy, who's whatever, who can you trust.
Right.
In this case, it's the government. I mean, you might think of the scientist character as representing the government and the power, corrupt power going wild and things like that. But it's really about the cynicism of, oh, no, it's not about who you can trust. It's already too late. That we've already fucked the world to such an extent that there's no future. It is quite a bait and switch, all the poster art. Especially with the Damned name and thinking of things like Children of the Damned, the idea it's like, oh, this is going to be about creepy psychic kids or something like that, or kids who, you know, with massive power. They're not. They're just these poor kids, right?
I know.
And the fact that the movie ends with them kind of just like crying out for help, it's so sad.
Yeah, I'm thinking like the alternate ending of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is definitely a sci-fi 50s movie, but about who can you trust, because it's like communism and that threat, but which is interesting considering Joseph Losey being blacklisted.
Mm-hmm,
but
absolutely.
But that ending where it's just Kevin McCarthy saying, like, you know, it's too late, or they're already here, or whatever he says.
You're next. That's what he
You're next. Right, that's it. Yeah. Like, if and it definitely has that feeling. But I hadn't even thought about that till you mentioned that.
Well, and I think the bleakness in this one, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels to me like while there is, like, you're watching the drama play out, like there is drama, ultimately, once you know what's going on, it somehow plods forward while fully knowing that there all the drama has left, right? Like, because there's no saving the kids, right? And all these people who've been with the kids are already dead. They were dead, you know, within the first 10 minutes of being in that room. They're done. Like, it's just a question of how gross their death was going to be, right? Like, it's there's something about it where when it's finally revealed what the full impact of what is going on is, it's like, oh, it doesn't matter how this movie ends because I know how it has to end. You know what I mean? Like, even if they pulled out some crazy zinger of something, it ultimately doesn't matter because in the end, there's a bunch of radioactive kids in a cave and they can't leave that cave. You know what I mean? Like, there was just something about that move dramatically that I just found even more cruel than just something that ends in like a sad way. Right. It was like, oh, this whole movie, you've been mean to me. Even when I didn't know, even when I thought this was going to be silly, you knew that this was going to be bad for everyone. And yet you let me watch. Thank you.
Hope you didn't start caring about anybody that you just saw.
Oh, yeah, God. Yeah.
And even with the death of the sculptor, right? This like sort of sculptor who is both attracted to this system, but also is living outside of it, right? Like, she's sort of got her foot in whatever. I'm sitting there going, well, I don't know if they knew this at the time, but I know she's going to get cancer too. There's no way she's that close to those kids.
Sure, right.
Yeah. She's not getting, like, that's the one thing about this movie that is, like, as much as I would say that many parts of this movie you could say are naive or corny or whatever, the only part that's fully just so not real that it's silly is the part of the premise where any of those people are getting out of there alive. But I just don't think people fully knew how intense radiation was. So they thought like, oh, they're behind walls, I'm sure it's fine. It's like, no, all those people are done. Like, this is the
stop, drop, and roll.
Duck and cover.
Duck and cover. Yeah. Yeah, this is a duck. Put on your glasses. You'll be fine.
Exactly, get under your desk.
Oh, jeez. It's funny because talking about, oh no, you know, these people are doomed from the beginning. Why did I even think that anything good was going to happen? It's funny because when watching it again and remembering, oh yeah, the ending's really bleak, but not remembering the exact trajectory of it. When Joan is on the boat with Simon and he's, you know, getting really handsy, I'm thinking, oh man, like, she should just stay on that damn boat because at least she could file a police report if he rapes her. She goes to this island, she's like really shit out of luck. Like, the idea that being on that boat with him is better. And she keeps saying, no, take me to shore, take me to shore. It's like, no, just stay on the boat. Just stay on the damn boat.
That is something like I can't really say how early 1960s eyes saw the relationship between Simon and Joan in this movie, but I can tell you how 2024 eyes.
It is not a good look.
Not a good look. Not a great look to take a woman who is, what, 20 years your junior, that obviously there's a power dynamic difference here, take her out on a boat where she has no escape whatsoever, and then grab her and start kissing her, and like, you're supposed to be ostensibly the good guy, and maybe that is fucking weird and freaky and it makes you really uncomfortable to watch. Though I'm glad that's why this movie really does kind of shift in when we're talking about the melding of genres. It's not the cleanest melding at all times, right? At the point where that they're in that boat, it's like, this is a science fiction movie or this is a horror movie, like, what is this supposed to be? And then once they reach this island and the conflict becomes more about, you know, their interactions with the children, it's like all of that goes away. It's only to establish that they have a strong relationship. But do they? They've only known each other for a fucking day. And the first thing that happened is him being inappropriate with her and then getting the shit beat out of him.
Yeah.
Oh,
I want to point out that Edward MacDonald Carey was born in 1913. So at the filming of this, he was 48.
Okay.
Oh my God.
And her character, so maybe he's supposed to be 40, but to me, he looked older than 48.
I would say that that's the case.
It was a hard living 48.
And she's supposed to be 20, you know, and, you know, obviously the actress looks a little older than that, but the idea, like, I think, Doug, you were being generous by saying a 20-year difference.
I was.
And even with a 20-year difference, it's not like a 20-year difference where it's a 30-year-old and a 50-year-old, right? Like, there's a certain age where it's like, oh, okay, you're into old people, whatever. It's like, no, that's a child. Like, it's not.
Yeah.
That's a child. You know, what are we doing here? So I'm already, like, just the fact that, like, he is interested in her before he becomes, you know, I'm just going to, you know, force this issue. Even before that, I'm uncomfortable, right? Because
yes,
of their age difference. And then he becomes aware of the unhealthy dynamic between her and her brother. Yet another thing that I'm like, okay, man, what are we doing here? And then he's just like, well, I tried to force the issue and it didn't work out. Well, I'm sure if I just stick around, eventually she'll change her mind. And then when she does change her mind, I'm like, all right, come on, movie. What are we doing?
Oh, well, look how sad her life is. It's like,
yeah.
She's got no options on one end. And then, this other quote unquote option, which is not great either. Like, I feel terrible for her.
And it's not
she's
clear
not in
that
a good role. Position.
It's not clear that King's protection of her it kind of suggests maybe some nefarious intentions on his part as well. So, I don't know that there's a lot of under the surface in the movie, which is fine. Like, it's 1961, they're not going to put everything on the table, right? But I don't know how much of it is like being hinted or not. There's like,
incestuousness there is definitely, clear that he's more than just like protecting her virginity.
yeah. They toned it down from the book. Okay. What it makes me think of is, I don't know how to say this. Like, I like this quote from one of the articles written by Stephen Carver, where he quotes a journalist and also a biker, because in this article, The Geometry of Fear, he really talks about motorcycle gangs and the evolution of them from the 50s to the 60s and the 70s and where this fits in. And this guy, Mike Seat, said, "Moody and sullen, Oliver Reed is easily the best aspect of this movie," and then added, "at times he appears so intent on destroying someone or something that he makes the threat of radioactive offspring seem attractive by comparison." And what it made me think is he's such a brute. Like, he's almost like he's just like id. Like, he's as much of a child as the children in that basement. It's almost like he has no maturity, no emotional intelligence. He's just like urge, jealousy, punch. Like, there's no nuance to him at all. And he almost feels like some sort of experiment himself in a weird way. It makes me think of his performance in another movie, The Shuttered Room, which it's like, imagine King, but, he's not going to become poisoned by radioactive stuff. But it's like a very similar type of character.
I think about the part where they're right outside the walls of this experimental area and they're about to be hunted down by the police that they have there. But before that, you have Simon and Joan, and they're being tracked down by the Teddy Boys, by the gang, right? And they look to one side and there's like three guys coming their way. And then they look to another direction and it's just Oliver Reed, and he's even more terrifying than a whole group of these other guys, because he's so impulsive and violence is so much of what he's about that it's almost like, would you rather take your chances with these three guys? You might have a chance with that. He might kill you if you go in his direction. Yeah, you really get the impression that, especially with that one scene with him and the sculptor, which is a really interesting scene. It might be one of my favorite in the movie, where you see that he's so frustrated and so angry. Yeah, it's if this is what the children are like right now, maybe we are better off all being irradiated. But I did want to read you a quote, Leslie, which is from a friend of mine, Rob Trench, a writer in Toronto. He wrote on Letterboxd, you might take offense at this. This is about this movie specifically.
I'm so offended. No, I'm kidding.
Oliver Reed can't act to save his life at this point, but he is fairly easy on the eyes. Would you agree that it's a weak performance? That seems to be quite at odds. I mean, you could make a case that you could give a weak performance while still being the highlight of the entire movie. But what do we think of Oliver Reed's performance? This is 1961, still pretty early, same year that he made Curse of the Werewolf, right? So this is pretty early in the Oliver Reed career.
I think the weakness of the role, and I thought about this, is his attempt to do like sort of a low-class accent. I think that's what weakens it.
I'm so glad you said
this. Because in the beginning, it sounds like he has a speech impediment, and I had forgotten that he sounds like that. And I see why they didn't want him to sound like his real accent, because it is very public school or whatever we said in a previous episode.
Sure.
But like it, his physicality, his look, and his like glowering is perfect. But really, it's the accent that, because it feels like he's acting when he's doing that accent, and I never feel like that with him. And I think that's if, once you get used to it, it's like, okay. But in the beginning, it's like, ooh.
Are you sure that you got used to it, or did he drop it midway through the movie?
Well, he cut.
I feel like towards the middle of the movie, he just stops doing it as intensely as he did in the beginning. Yeah,
that's a good point. That's
I started to wonder if maybe the character forgot where he was from. You know what I mean? Like
the radiation made him lose his accent.
Well, it's like, I was thinking like maybe it was put on. Maybe that's not his real, especially because she doesn't have.
Oh my god!
Their accents do not match up. She does.
That
not
would
sound
make
like
a lot of sense.
And like he does voices, like that's something he used to. But he does at the beginning of the movie use that utterly ridiculous, lower class from another part of the country accent multiple times at the beginning of the movie, enough that I'm like, is that supposed to be he's doing a silly voice, or is that supposed to be his voice? And I thought, well, it doesn't make sense because not all the other Teddy boys or bikers, whatever they're supposed to be, have that accent, right? Their accent
sort of does, but most of them don't. Yeah.
And she doesn't have that at all. She sounds totally proper, which maybe that's just in England, that just makes her more sympathetic, than she had.
Well, a few times she did seem like she was trying to do a voice, and then she dropped it too, which would be interesting. And their parents were killed, right? I think that's the premise. So, I mean, that would make sense that they had to put on these personas to try to get by because they were orphans.
I mean,
that's a lot of subtext to explain a dodgy accent.
I mean, that's the thing. For me, I just thought, look, like when it comes to performance wise, I to some extent, you have to cut an actor some amount of slack for a script, right?
And
so this script is not looking for Oliver Reed. It's looking for anyone who's going to be crazy and scary, right? And so he brings that. But the accent was the consistent thing that I was like, yo, what is going on with him right now? Like, it was really distracting, honestly. And
yes, it was.
I don't know that you could point to another performance in the movie that's stronger, really, than him. So it's hard for me to say that it's a bad performance. And I do think there is something about the character, though. Like, when you, Leslie, you were talking about his... The movie seems to suggest that maybe his antisocial whatever, his cruelty, comes from a sense that the whole world is sort of unfair, And it's maybe like a working class anger or something, right? Like, it doesn't get very specific, but it's sort of like a frustration with the world. And that's why the one part that I found very compelling is towards the end of the movie where he's so deflated. He's lost all his rebellion. He's lost all his sass. He just seems like a sad man. And I think it's because he's finally found people who are, without a doubt, treated more unfairly than he is. He is no longer the victim of the world. He sees these kids and he's thinking two things. One, what's happening to these kids is utterly unfair and they should not be treated this way. Two, I cannot help these kids. Being around them is killing me. I need to escape right now. Like, all
he
wants to do is not help them.
To that one kid, you're poisoning me.
Yeah. And he's in this thing where he's seeing that he is, it's not circumstance, right? He is ultimately, regardless of what his circumstances are, self-interested and kind of a coward. You know what I mean? Like, I just think he sees himself in a way, and he sees that these kids have like, I mean, here's the thing. These are kids who are trapped in a cave for 11 years, and then they get a chance to get out, and they're, like, immediately, like, ready to fight the world. Like, granted, they're little kids, so they all get captured, but, like, it really is like, man, these guys got a lot of spunk. They just been in that room.
Yeah.
Like, where do they exercise? Like, how do they get so active? Like, they just are like, I'm getting out of here. And I'm like, all of these kids are cooler than him. And he killed a guy, you know? What?
And he knows it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you notice that his character also has a kind of a strange conservatism to him, right? Because he kept talking about morals and ethics. Like, when he runs into the sculptor woman,
yeah,
he's talking about how there's no morals in the world anymore. And part of the reason that he says that he's protective over his sister is because of the lack of morals of other people, which is, you know, of course, ironic because he spends his whole days just beating the shit out of people randomly.
Yeah, and his morals are very up at odds with each other.
But the idea was that that they can justify that to themselves because they get these men who are hitting on his sister, so they're obviously immoral, which in this case, he actually is pretty right. That guy's a piece of shit.
Yeah,
find out throughout the movie. But it is interesting that he's so morally focused, and it's almost like you were just saying, Liam, that by the end he's deflated also because he found a situation that is so immoral, that is so much more than he could ever think about himself as being victimized, that it's not the ending of his character is a suicide, right? But it's a suicide that he's going to die anyway, so it doesn't have as much of a meaning as a suicide. But it's just like, what else can he do but die at that point?
Mm-hmm. When he first started showing a bit of his conservatism, I kind of made the mistake of giving the movie too much credit on the Teddy Boy thing, because Teddy Boys were very conservative. In fact, that style is still mm-hmm. popular with various neo-Nazi groups. They're still
I was reading that. I did not
boys.
Know that.
Yeah, because it was an essentially a conservative move. But I don't think that's really what's. I don't think they really know anything about that subculture. Honestly, I think it's more like.
No, I agree.
I think it's more just like a projection that like of a certain kind of. Of a certain kind of posh liberal mindset that says, well, all poorer people are probably more conservative, right? Like, it's sort of an assumption. I think they're just sort of projecting, like, this guy beats up tourists. Of course that's him. As opposed to him being, like, a libertine who's like, I'm just trying to enjoy life. Like, it's mm-hmm. not clear he enjoys anything other than beating people up. And even when
I don't know that he even enjoys that. I think he's just reacting.
Yeah. Everything about him just seems kind of like he's getting through the day, but there's no sort of happiness there. There's a gleeful cruelty, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. I was reading in the What Fresh Lunacy Is This book, and well, two of the articles that I read, the ones that are more like film essays, talked about the similarity of King, to Alex and his droogs in A Clockwork Orange. And then there was some discussion, like, did this inspire A Clockwork Orange? Did it not? Like, is the timing too close? And I was looking in Hellraisers, and it said that Reed's performance did inspire Burgess to write A Clockwork Orange.
I don't see how that makes any sense.
And that was also repeated in Evil Spirits. And I'm like, how is the timing doesn't seem right? Like, where is this coming from?
Unless Burgess saw it before it got a full release. But even if it did, A Clockwork Orange was published in 1962, right? Which this movie was made in 61, but not released in the UK until 63. I think it's one of those things where it's like, well, that would be great if there was a clear influence. I think it's more likely that Anthony Burgess was inspired by gangs like this, you know what I mean?
I think just a synchronicity,
shared inspiration, right? And the fact that probably there was a lot of stories in the news about roving gangs, violent gangs, things like that. I don't know. It's hard to think that he was directly influenced at the very.
It's not like it's now where information travels like at the speed of light. Like, I could see, if there was like a TikTok video or something, and then, somebody turned that into a movie 2 weeks later. Like, things didn't move so fast back then.
I think the inclusion of a gang in this movie just feels like chasing sort of what was already an established kind of trend, you know? So
absolutely.
The idea that he included young ruffians in his, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, young ruffians, it wasn't even just a genre trope, it was a reality, right? Like, post-World War II was the beginning of a various... You know what this movie made me think of, though? Have you guys ever seen that... you might not know what I'm talking about. Have you ever seen that British skinhead PSA from the 80s?
No, I saw
that recently for the first time. I'm almost certain.
Literally, it's a PSA, Leslie, that is like, hey, don't judge skinheads just because some are bad. And in it, instead of saying subcultures, which is what we've come to call them, she keeps calling all these different groups cults. She just calls them cults.
I have seen this.
So distracting. And
that's embarrassing.
And one of the cults that she mentions is Teddy's. And her whole thing is like, oh, they're all just kids doing their thing. We're just like them. And I'm like, you want to include the Teddies in that? Because they really are pretty bad. Like, what are we doing here? Like, what's happening?
Wow.
You know, it's a very weird commercial. But this whole movie just made me think of that. And I thought, well, of course Clockwork Orange would include. In fact, you could maybe say, how could a Clockwork Orange or any vision of the future from, you know, that time not include roving angry teenagers, right? Because it had become such a phenomena, but it's a phenomena that it's hard to know if it was as present in reality as it was in the imagination. My suspicion is it might have been, but it is hard to know. But I just know that there have been, since World War II in England, just all these, you know, a fashion comes about and then kids beat each other up about it. That seems to be the vibe.
And I mean, this era would have been mod rocker battles, you know, nonstop. Mm-hmm. And England, that was the thing that was dominating the news. By the way, I didn't realize, and this, I feel so silly for not realizing, that one of the reasons that biker gangs arose post-World War II is that there was a surplus of all these motorcycles from the war that just made themselves.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's one of the articles mentioned it, right? It's just like, that's what led in the U.S.
Oh, I totally missed that.
For things like the Wild One and all the motorcycle culture stuff that came out of that.
Okay,
that,
I know that section, yeah.
There were tons of motorcycles available for low cost, so that's why everyone had one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I like, so in What Fresh Lunacy Is This, you know, when they're mentioning the Clockwork Orange connection, potential connection. Apparently Ken Russell was suggested as a possible director. So at the time, that seems like there's a chance that Oliver Reed could have played Alex. Like, that's insane to me. Like, I've heard
a dozen different stories about potential casting for a Clockwork Orange adaptations. I know at one point that even Stanley Kubrick was going to cast the Rolling Stones as.
Oh, yes, I saw that too.
That's a pretty famous one. I think the Beatles wanted to be part of a Clockwork Orange because think about the time.
Well, that would have ruined their careers for sure.
but think about 1962, man. Right? And think about this book kind of taking off in the mid 60s.
Yeah.
And I'm sure every, you know, musician had their eye to have doing a film career after the Beatles broke through like that. And so it kind of made sense in a more sanitized version. But yeah, you're right. You could kind of see the Rolling Stones, but it is interesting to think of what we were talking about in the last episode of The System, about how Oliver Reed's character in that is supposed to be kind of aging out of that kind of character. That's 64, right? Now this is 61. He is of the age then, but boy, that is like that Alex character from A Clockwork Orange. It has to be kind of a nebulous late teens, early 20s age. And it's just like Oliver Reed always looks just a little bit older than what he actually is. Though in all reality, of course, he's already in his mid-20s even at this point.
Right, right. Well, but he doesn't look as old as McDonald Carey. That's for sure.
That's for damn sure. I think the other, I mean, none of the other gang folks look to be teens really to me. Like, and right. maybe that's just an age bias that people look different, but he still looks older than all, you know what I mean? Like maybe I was carrying some of the system with me because the vibe in the system is like, he's the elder with all these young sort of minions running around. This still felt that way. And I don't think it was meant to. I think they're supposed to all feel the same age. But
he's got that fancy jacket and the gloves, and he definitely stands out.
Yeah. I mean, it is true that here's a plot that they're supposed to be either biker gang or teddy boys, whatever, and Oliver Reed turns his character into a dandy, right? Like, just, you know, they're all wearing matching leather jackets except for Oliver Reed. It's like, well, I'm in charge. It's like, yeah, but I mean, come on. What is that jacket you have on? Like, what's happening right now? But, you know.
This is Streets of Fire. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I do think there's a, good pull with Streets of Fire, by the way. I do think there's a question in a way of like, Oliver Reed is very, his performances are very large, you know, and he is very intimidating. I don't know that he actually works for it's Alex, right, in Clockwork Orange?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that I think he's too intellectual. I think it would be, it would be tough.
I mean,
yeah, but that doesn't that kind of work, though? I mean, the whole idea, I mean, that's a very similar kind of role where Alex is supposed to be
that's true. Like,
almost preternaturally a leader, and but also the kind of person who could talk down. I mean, it would change the dynamic, certainly, because Malcolm McDowell and Oliver Reed are very, very different kinds.
Extremely.
I'm probably biased because of Malcolm McDowell, but in my brain, Malcolm McDowell has a threateningness that isn't about overwhelming power. It's more about you don't know what he's gonna do, right? Like he just seems unpredictable. And it's like, again, not that Oliver Reed seems predictable, but his unpredictability is less like he's a crazy guy and more like, I don't know, he probably had a few too many drinks before he got here.
He's more of a brute, right?
That's a brute
type character.
Yeah.
He would work better really as the henchman of someone like Malcolm McDowell, honestly.
Right. How do you feel?
I was just going to say it's hard to picture an actor who could diminish Oliver Reed in a way and make him feel subordinate. But then I think about how Klaus Kinski does that to him.
Yeah.
Venom. Klaus Kinski as David Bowie in Venom.
That's exactly right, though, Liam, right? It's like he would make a great henchman, like one of the henchmen who gets fucking put up, like he gets so fed up with being treated like a henchman. You could see like the rage increasing until they. Yeah. And then him being like one of the police officers at the end, dunking Malcolm McDowell's head in. I mean, those characters are too small for what Oliver Reed would have been playing, but it's interesting to think about.
Leslie, what were you going to say? You were going to ask.
I was going to say that, you know, the first time I saw it, which was, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. I had the same, like, what is this movie? Like, where is it going? What kind of movie is this? It was just like very, I felt like I didn't have a full grasp of what I was in for. And of course, this time I had a little bit more, okay, I remember this movie is weird and it kind of goes all over the place. And so it felt more cohesive to me this time around. But when I started thinking about it, I started thinking that it really plays out like a horror film. And in particular, I'm thinking of that horror movie trope, and I don't know what you really call it, but it's like bad guys who try to start something and then they get met with something worse, like Last House on the Left or Don't Breathe or No One Lives or something like that. Or there's something that you think is a threat. And it's sort of like another version of that, what I just said. There's a threat, but then, oh no, there's something worse than that threat. So like 28 Days Later or The Descent where, okay, you know, they go to this cave and they don't have a map. And this woman is, you know, upset because she finds out that her friend has been, or her husband's been cheating on her with her friend. Oh, but there's like monsters in there. So that's the real threat. Or 28 Days Later, which when you're talking about the scientist character, it really made me think of 28 Days Later and the Christopher Eccleston character because, oh, they're zombies. It's terrible. Then they go to this army camp and they're like, oh, we're fine. Nope, you're totally not fine because Chris Eccleston is like the scientist in this movie where he's like, nope, that's it. The world is over, so we just have to procreate and we're going to rape women and that's just how it's going to be. And the one subordinate is like, nope, there's a plane. There's no way that, you know, the whole world is like this. But Christopher Eccleston is like, nope, that's it. If you don't follow suit with what I think, then I'm going to chain you to a radiator or kill you or whatever. And it's interesting how it does go through that similar trajectory. But I don't think that that type of horror movie was a thing in 1961. Like maybe The Night of the Living Dead is kind of like that because, oh, they get stuck in the house at the end and then the people in the house are pretty horrible. But that's like much later in the 60s. Were there other things like this at that time?
It's interesting. I bet there's a Western that it has a similar kind of thing where the good and bad guys have to work together against a larger threat. But that threat wouldn't be like a threat that is a threat to the entire world. But I love, right. I mean, you're exactly right, though. Those kind of movies, it's so fascinating to think of, these characters who are the good guys, they are under threat by the bad guys. And then a much, much larger threat is introduced where it's just like, oh, shit, this is way bigger than any of our petty squabbles or even our somewhat larger squabbles, which are violence towards one another. We need to put it down. You know, it's almost like that idea from Watchmen, right? The giant squid making everyone in the world come together. I thought of the Return of the Living Dead in this as well, right? That one is less defined in terms of good and bad guys, but just these two disparate groups coming together and having to work together against a apocalyptic event that is going on all around them. It's just such, this one is such a strange example of that because it's pre-apocalyptic, right? It's about the threat of what is to come. And from the perspective of the scientist in this case, it being a done deal, you know, for him, yeah, morality, a lot of morality, at least the morality of what they have here is thrown out the window. But as it's made clear in the movie, these kids are like, they could never be introduced into society. They were part of a unfortunate thing where they'd already been doused with this radiation. They can't exist in any other context except locked away from the rest of the world. So from his perspective, right, he's not torturing them. He's giving them the only life that he possibly could, while also helping with the potential future of humanity. I do like a movie like this where it's just like, yeah, look, he obviously is evil and you can't justify the actions of what he's doing, but his reasoning is sound from a perspective. I do like that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, when he reveals that they just found them this way, that they didn't make these kids. These were kids who were survivors of various nuclear accidents, right? That sort of says, like, ayo, this has been again, like I said before, it's been a sadness trick from the beginning. Because even if they did it, because if they did it to them, right, then you could say, well, now they need to blow up the facility and everybody dies because there's a justice to that. But it's like, even though what they're doing is horrible, what's the other option? That they kill all the kids? You know what I mean? Like, it seems like the best case scenario that is that these kids live out their days in a less lying facility where they can't interact with people. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's like, I think in the context too, I think it's harder now because we all know that his like pontificating about the inevitability of nuclear holocaust, we all know that that's not necessarily the case, though the, you know, the final reveal hasn't come in yet. It could still happen. But at least in that context, his feeling that, like, yeah, you know, any day now the bombs are going to fly. It's weird to see it now and go, nah, man, it's not like that, actually. But like at the time, I wonder if there were people watching this going, yeah, I don't know. There's nothing else he could do. This makes the most, you know what I mean? Like, I would like to think that everyone is horrified, but I don't actually know, especially like the way that we've seen now that movies have an intention, like the audience will respond this way and then they fucking don't. I wonder if there are people watching this in 1963 when it came out saying, I don't know. I mean, what else is he supposed to do? Which is like the saddest thing, but it's very possible, you know?
I mean, in a way he's like a child because he can't see anything but that inevitable future.
Right.
He's like, it's almost like when you're young and you don't have perspective, like, oh, this is the worst thing ever. I cannot see behind, you know, beyond the next like 10 minutes, much less the next 4 years. He's like that, but in a way where it's like, no, this is what's going to happen. Like, you know, I can see the future and this is the future and that's it. Like I'm not having any discussion. That's, I think, makes him less evil as just frightening. Like, I don't think he's malicious. I think he's just, it's like a reptile that you just can't communicate with him because he's so single-minded.
But it's the murder of, oh, sorry, just quickly, Liam, it's the murder of the sculptor that turns, like it pushes him over the edge a little bit more.
Yeah, oh, that's
because
true.
Everything
else
is a lot more passive, right? That's just an active thing. It's like he is hurting someone who did not deserve to be hurt, who, you know, I mean, she's probably damned anyway because of her being so close to the radiation, but it feels more like actively evil than almost anything else we see. It's almost like to remind you as the audience, hey, wait, no, this guy's a bad guy, right? He's bad. So
true.
Well, I was gonna say it's where for me where the horror switches focus. So like the horror part of the horror earlier is more related to a 50s scenario in which sometimes the horror is just science has done a terrible thing. And now we must deal with the ramifications of the terrible thing science did. And it switches to the horror that there are people who are so sure, right? Mm. That they're right and are willing to use whatever circumstances to their benefit, that they will do horrible things, right? Mm. So it's sort of like you were saying, Doug. On one hand, everyone is kind of fucked already. Like, if radiation is so bad that kids are turning out like this, then, you know, the world's already in a pretty bad spot, right? But it turns when he reveals that how willing, how certain he is. The whole, you know, thing has been exposed. His closest, the only person he cares about in the world is now aware. And instead of, like, saying, well, let's just close up shop or do something else, he's willing to kill, you know, and without really much, it seems, remorse. Then the horror becomes, I suspect, the people making this movie are not seeing this guy as on their side. So part of this horror is they're assuming an audience who's watching this going, fuck, that is what the government would do, right? Like, they're saying, right, like, oh, people are like this. And so, like, yeah, the irradiated children is pretty scary and all of that's really scary, but the scariest thing is this guy, and that's the real horror, is like, oh, this is exact, for all we know, this is happening right now because we can't trust the people in charge. And that I found way even more, yeah, bleak than the poor irradiated children.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't he have poisoned or given her, like, you know, a sleeping pill? It's like, you just shoot her. It's apparently Losey wanted her to be shot from the helicopter, and the studio was like, no, we can't do that. I mean, can you imagine?
The thing is, Leslie,
that would have been really brutal.
Well, the thing is, Leslie, she could have walked whatever 20 miles to get on a boat to then get to somewhere where there's a phone. And then, right, she could have called someone and they maybe have believed her that there's irradiated children living in a cave.
Right,
like, right, the whole idea that she's going to expose this thing, like, that's his motivation, right? Is he's got to protect the mission. I'm like, motherfucker, no one's going to believe this lady. Like, what do you think is at stake right now? Like, there's in reality, there's nothing at stake. But for the sake of the movie, it had to happen. To
I think he's just mad because he told his lackey, like, don't let her know what's going on. And then, of course, all hell breaks loose and he's like, well, I guess I gotta kill you now because you're not gonna like it. You're not gonna, you know, this is it. It's either we break up or I kill you. Those are the options.
This movie does feel a little like a precursor to those 1980s movies that are still Cold War thinking, which is the idea that what's the point of surviving if we lost our humanity in the survival, right?
Yes.
Which is almost voiced, I think, by some of the characters in this movie, which is like, you know, look, maybe you'd be glad that someone did these immoral things to make sure that humanity carried on. But, like, what would humanity look like from the results of this sort of work? It's funny. I watched the first episode of the Fallout TV show today, which,
oh, sure,
that starts with a really kind of intense sequence where it feels like that, you know, set in the 1950s, where an alternate 1950s, where humanity is on the brink. Right. And it's basically the reason that all those Fallout shelters are already built is because there's a feeling that it's inevitable, that it's going to happen any day now. And just the idea of living within that, and especially, you know, audiences who were seeing this in 1963, which there's probably a lot of people who really did feel that there's no way they're going to make it through the rest of their life without having a horrific nuclear incident occur.
They have to get under their desk.
And, yeah, they got to get under the desk. And the reality is that the government has been lying to them, and they're already cynical about that, especially at this time period. And that cynicism would only grow about what the government's intentions are. And you think about Dr. Strangelove and the end of that, of course, and all the discussions they're having about the cave and the mine shaft gap and things like that. I'll tell you, the cynicism of this movie feels like it is echoing the cynicism of the world in a way much more accurately than a lot of the other science fiction movies at that time period.
Yeah. I mean, that's partly what I was so struck by, is the idea that we're transitioning to a period where horror is going to reflect a lot more of people's actual feelings than just a general, like, oh no, we did too many tests and now the ants are big or whatever.
I'm just glad that we're finally past all that and we don't have any nuclear fear.
Oh my gosh. That's what I was going to say. It's like,
lucky? Aren't we so lucky?
Like I said, I was going to say, like, oh, well, it turns out he's wrong. And I'm like, well, actually, on a long enough timeline, he might not be wrong. But at least, like,
I'm writing on Twitter right now, get the kids in the cave, get it all prepped.
Oh, I just want to talk about Joseph Losey quickly, but I mean, of course, I know about the servant. I know about the accident, but I've never seen either of them. So he's somebody that, of course, we learned about in my film classes because of his, like, sort of anti-establishment tendencies. And his refusal to testify at the McCarthy hearings and mm-hmm. how he was blacklisted. But I did not realize that he directed Modesty Blaze, which I absolutely love that movie because I'm a big fan of the Modesty Blaze books. Mm-hmm. And it's not a perfect adaptation, but it's so fun. And I find that is a movie that this same director made mind-blowing because they could not be further apart in tone. And I'm wondering, have you seen any of his, have either of you seen his other films?
Only other film I've seen by him except for Modesty Blaze is The Go-Between, which he made in the 70s.
That looked really good. I was reading about that.
But I saw that years and years back, and I'm looking through his filmography now. And I mean, obviously a director with a head on his shoulders, you know what I mean? And I don't mean to be dismissive in regards to his work, but I just mean that it makes sense that a science fiction movie from a director like this would maybe have a little bit more going on than some exploitation-esque movies.
Exactly.
You know, we haven't really mentioned this was a Hammer production, right? And like, so, and even at this point, this would have been because after the first Dracula movie, after the first Frankenstein movie, so they were establishing themselves as this horror central place. But also, it must have been after, or maybe around the same time as the first Quatermass movie. So it's the idea of them doing science fiction that had more of a heady atmosphere to it mm-hmm. is something that would have been established. So it's interesting, and what a treat for them to have a respected director who, I mean, he had to leave the United States for the reasons that you just said, but how nice to have such a high quality director who was attaching himself to a project that otherwise might have someone might not have put so much care towards.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, I'm pretty unfamiliar with his stuff, you know, like looking through, I'm like,
yeah,
and I don't really, there's a few here that I've heard of, like, or I've even just seen the posters for example, Boom is a movie that I've always been like, what is this movie? What? I've never quite understood the tendency to put punctuation in movie titles, like an exclamation point. So it kind of stood out to me. But weirdly, I actually have seen one of his movies, but I didn't know his name at all. I've seen Secret Ceremony. And I think I just saw it because it looked like some crazy, you know what I mean? Like, it's a very intriguing poster. The premise is kind of interesting. And so it's just one of those things that I got, honestly, during that time when you could just, you know, get DVDs from Netflix, right? Like,
yes.
I would just put anything that looked interesting into my queue. So I had no idea that this was.
I did that with zip.ca. I saw a lot of really weird stuff.
Yeah. So, but I wasn't aware of it being part of his like filmography or anything. So, and honestly, I don't remember a ton about it other than, you know, getting it because this poster was so interesting to me. But, So, you know, I'm curious to see some of these other things now just because
I am too. Yeah.
This is a certain kind of genre film that could land a certain way. And I think that while he obviously didn't write the book, so we can't put all of the bleakness of the movie on him, it takes a certain amount of guts to put even as much of it, even though I get the feeling the book is more intense, to put as much of it as he did into the movie, you know, at all, like even to have a movie end with the idea that like, yeah, no one's gonna, there's no, you know, not that movies didn't have unhappy endings, but this is like next level to me, that all those children just got to go back in the cave is like really asking a lot of the audience, I think.
We didn't really mention, by the way, that the reason that this movie didn't come out in 1961 when it was supposed to is because it was given an X rating when it was brought to the censors.
Right.
And in fact, there was the version that was seen in the United States was cut down to 77 minutes when the version we saw was 90 minutes. So that's a lot of material cut out of it, which is, you know, you watch it, it seems fairly tame. I mean, I can't even imagine what it was that was so objectionable at the time.
I feel like one of the things I read was the implication that those characters would have sex and that that King was had incestuous feelings towards his sister.
That's still like 15 minutes which cut out. That's ridiculous.
I know. It's crazy. I know. It's really crazy. Would you recommend this though? Like, not, I mean, would you recommend it as an Oliver Reed film, or would you recommend it as just a film on its own without, you know, I mean, obviously you can't say, oh, if he wasn't in it, but you know what I mean?
He is a distraction to a certain extent in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Because he would become so much more famous later, more famous probably to 2024 audiences than anyone else that you see in the movie. However, he also is very central to the movie, and he's playing not necessarily the kind of role he was known for, but certainly the fact that he is so overwhelming in that character is similar to a lot of the Oliver Reed roles that would be famous later on. So I think it's really important for his development as a performer. And mm-hmm. you can kind of see the DNA of this in something like The System, even though, you know, it's different in so many other ways. But Liam was saying it's funny to watch them in reverse order, that that's such a much more nuanced performance than what we have here. But you don't mm-hmm. get that without him sticking out in a movie like this and people seeing him and being like, well, what else can this guy do? So to me, it's like, yeah, for Oliver Reed enthusiasts, you definitely want to see this. But also just if you're kind of interested in more heady science fiction of the Cold War era, particularly non-US science fiction.
Yeah.
I think this is a really interesting one. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to people who are like, oh, I want to see the most distinctive examples of folk horror. But I do think in terms of once you've explored that genre a bit and want to see other directions it can go in, this would be a good thing to put on your list.
Well said. What do you think, Liam?
Yeah, I would also I would agree with everything Doug said, and then I'd include folks who are curious about Hammer movies that aren't the sort of most obvious kind of gothic stuff. I think for a lot of people, they really have no idea that Hammer made movies that aren't one of those Dracula or Frankenstein or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, there's a certain cliche, and it's just not true. They did a lot of different stuff, and this is a good example of something that feels to me, it reminds me of some of the Hammer I've seen, but might hit other people as totally outside their wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. What do we want to do next time?
Oh, that's a good question. I can't remember.
Where do we go from here?
I think it might be time to do one of his most distinctive roles.
Okay, I was thinking really, that too.
And I'll tell you, the one that had sprung to mind recently, I think it's a little early to tuck into The Devils.
Oh, man,
I think
yeah.
Maybe it might be time to talk about Women in Love.
I was thinking that. Boy, that's a... Oof. That movie took me like 3 times before I felt like I even knew half of what was going on. So I think that's a good choice. I have the book for that, too.
Oh, there you
go. So I could definitely read it and compare.
And we've already brought up Ken Russell in this episode, so
there's
a thorough line there, absolutely.
Yeah. Is there anything that you guys want to plug, or what else is going on, like your other podcasts or stuff that you think people would like to know about?
How about you, Leah? Why don't you start with your plugs?
I knew you were going to throw it to me, you jerk. obviously, you know, if people want to check out more of Cinema Smorgasbord, they can head over to cinepunks.com, which is our network family. Not only are our latest episodes over there, but new episodes of all kinds of podcasts, whether that's Horror Business, Twitch of the Death Nerve, Tomb of Ideas, Shameless Picture Show. A lot of fun podcasts over there. And some writing. We got some new people writing for us lately. So
nice.
Go ahead and check that out if you have a chance. And Cinepunks is on social media, CINEPUNX on, you know, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, whatever else.
Friend face and yeah.
Friendster.
My friends and yeah. Face Place and all those other ones that you hear about on Law and Order. What about you, Doug?
You can find the full archive of further reading over at cinemasmorgasbord.com, where you can also find a whole array of podcasts, including ones devoted to such diverse topics as the career of Carol Kane, Jackie Chan, George Kennedy, Alejandro Jodorowsky, plenty more over at cinemasmorgasbord.com or on Twitter at cinemasmorg, S-M-O-R-G, or do a search for Cinema Smorgasbord on Facebook as well. You can also find me somehow back on X/Twitter at Doug_Tilley. That's T-I-L-L-E-Y. I'm also on Blue Sky if you just do a search for Doug Tilley as well. And hey, while we're plugging stuff, I also have a podcast called No Budget Nightmares devoted to micro-budget cinema. You can find that at podcast.com. New episode coming soon, as I can get through this 2-hour faith-based Saw ripoff that I'm fucking struggling with, but I'll get there soon.
Whoa! Oh my God. Yeah, I'm intrigued by that. Well, I would like to, for anybody in the Toronto area, I am doing a screening series about the Danish actor Mads Mikkelsen every month at Eyesore Cinema, which is on Bloor West. And the first screening is on Thursday, April 25th. I don't know when this is going to air, but it'll be going on every month. And the first screening is The Salvation, which is a Danish Western with Mads and Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Eva Green. And it's really good. And it's directed by Christian Levering, who is part of the Dogma 95 school, even though they shot this in South Africa, but, you know, don't hold that against him. It's not actually in the American West. But anyway, so yeah, that's what I've been working on. And I will be adding some fun videos to the TikTok, the Further Reading TikTok and Instagram. Hopefully they won't, you know, delete them for copyright. But they have been really weird about anything with music. So I've been using just like stock music to avoid that problem. And that seems to work. But I have another really good, for the last movie for The System, I did a TikTok video where I compared Oliver Reed in The System to Robert Downey Jr. in the movie Tough Turf from 1986, which I'm so proud of. And this time, I know it sounds crazy, but I can make a case for comparing The Damned to a scene in Tough Turf. But this one is with James Spader, not Robert Downey Jr. So maybe I can figure out a way to compare every Oliver Reed movie to something from Tough Turf. I mean,
all roads lead to Tough Turf, apparently.
That would be a really niche thing that maybe like five people would give a shit about. But anyway, so yeah. But if you want to find me on social media, yes, Further Reading at Instagram. I really don't use Twitter much anymore, but I do use Instagram and I do use TikTok. And I'm on Facebook under my own name, but I don't really do anything exciting there. So, well, until next time, I am Leslie Hatton.
I'm Liam O'Donnell.
I'm Doug Tilley.
And we will see you on Further Reading in another 2 months. with Women in Love, directed by Ken Russell. Thanks.
Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling. Black leather.